Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Atlas Podcast. I'm Alex, you're Martin. How are you doing today?
We switched it up a bit there, Alex. I am Martin.
Keeping it fresh.
Well, caught me out. Brilliant. Yeah, well, I would say it's okay, but unfortunately, the good old COVID come knocking at my door, so I've been experiencing that. So I'm a little bit hoarse, but anyway, there's a joke.
It just, isn't it? Yeah, it gives you an air of something. I don't know.
Grandeur.
Bit of drama to the proceedings.
But drama, definitely drama.
Yeah. Okay. So on this episode, we're going to be looking at the roundabout stuff that goes on with, this new wind farm, largest ever that's being produced, and actually the archaeological knock-ons from that, and how technology is helping us look at archaeological sites that are now under the sea. We're also going to have a look at anarchic manufacturing, which is actually something we touched on briefly with Aydin Nasihi in last episode. But since we've gone away and done some reading and want to have a bit more of a discussion on it between ourselves. And then finally,
it's a great tag, isn't it? I mean, it just hooked onto anarchic manufacturing. You can't but go and investigate it further, can you? I mean,
That's not it. We didn't have enough time to go into it deep with Aydin. Hopefully he can come back and talk with us more because he's a real expert in the area. But you're right. Just the name itself, the title, does what it should do. Because you go, what is this? It's two words you don't expect to see together. Finally, we're joined by Mark Leitchens, who's going to talk to us about lots of techie stuff, and we'll get a bit nerdy with him.
Excellent. Look forward to it.
Cool. So, yeah, starting off, the area we're looking at is Dogger Bank, Doggerland, the lost Atlantis of the North Sea. This is something you turned up that, it's in relation to these huge wind farms that are being built, which is obviously great for green energy and renewables and things like that. But also there is a question around, do the same levels of care get given to archaeological sites that are under the sea as they would on land? Because obviously, as you mentioned, when we were off air, if you're building a new building and you come across, say, an old Roman ruin, it's sort of codified in law that you then have to have an archaeological study and the significance of it needs to be organized. But these areas that were previously, just after the first ice age or whatever, above water, don't necessarily have those protections. Now they're underwater.
And for me, there's many things that come into this story and why I was fascinated by it, because you're right, it's technology, it's archaeological. Where the entry to me was with this is the word Dogger Bank and the reference to the weather forecast around the UK. The shipping forecast and for those who are not aware, it has a link to one of my favourite sports, if not the favourite, cricket. Mm-hmm. And we were just discussing about the various things that go around these cultural identities, and obviously for the UK and many people around the globe, cricket is one of those things. But when you listen to cricket in the UK, especially in the past, you might have listened to Test Match Special on the radio, and if you're on a particular frequency during the broadcast, you'd have to break away from the cricket. And for those, I'm sure it's known, but some of the cricket matches can go on for 5 days. Mm-hmm. And you have to break away from the cricket if you're on Radio 4 long wave to listen to the shipping forecast. And the shipping forecast would have all of these, let's say, exotic names, let's call them that. And Dogger and Dogger Bank were one of those names, including German Bite and Fast Net and all of these other terminologies that you use to map out the oceans or the seas around the UK. And they've always been one of those things that's got a very poetic nature about it, the shipping forecast. And there's been many a tea towel written with the phrasing that goes along with the shipping forecast. So for me, these words are always a part and tied into the culture and the sport of cricket and the way it interrupts the broadcast. And so when I had an opportunity, I think, to raise a news article, I don't miss any opportunity to bring some of the favourite cultural references into that discussion, I guess.
No complaints from me.
Absolutely. And I think the interesting thing also with this one is about that land bridge that once was that linked the UK to mainland Europe. And this article touches on many of those things, really, because with the requirement, if you like, and the ever-increasing requirement for define the word security, if you like, and we've got energy security these days, food security, and all those other words that get wrapped up in these times around security. Energy security becomes a key part of those discussions. Depending on what your natural resources are, wind and solar energy and all these different types of renewable energy become increasingly important for countries. And the UK predominantly have built their wind turbine farms offshore because we do have a lot of sea around us, and that sea can be quite close to the surface. And one of the fascinating things with this article I was reading, and this vast area of land that they used to connect the UK to mainland Europe, I think, what was the phrase that you saw, where you can walk from?
You could walk from the Yorkshire Dales to Denmark.
Which is a beautiful phrase, isn't it?
Yeah.
You'd have to cross a few rivers along the way.
You would, yeah. There's a few valleys, a few rivers, but you could technically get across.
Yeah, and those rivers that were used to be there, I still exist, but they're under the sea now. So you can see these riverbeds under the sea. And the Dogger Bank area in there is a huge area, only 15 meters under the sea.
That's incredible.
Which is fascinating. Yeah. And there's also a lot of these submerged forests that still live under the sea, but you can fossilize submerged forests. And you can actually see some of these forests still at low tide, which great for quite an eerie example, really. You can see this Atlantis, if you like, that used to live, and these cultures and where people used to live and hunter-gatherers used to be on these lands. And really was quite a fascinating article going around that that era. Was it 15,000 to 5,000 years ago when this period
sort of
landed?
Yeah, sort of end of the last ice age into the real warming up, which is, I guess, when most of the ice caps sort of started to melt again, and that sea level started to rise again. There's a little ecological window there where it's not too cold to live there, but it's also not underwater. And obviously we filled that niche whilst we could.
Absolutely. And so that's a great area to build these, they already are building and continue to build offshore wind turbines in that space. So as a part of that, as we kind of alluded to, with all of this kind of excavation and need for energy security and to decarbonize the world, there's also a knock-on effect with that. That's why it's important to understand these things, even if it's consigned to a watery grave because of the rising sea levels. And at one point, it's supposed to be when it actually created that channel between there's a bit of a series of mega tsunamis that devastated that coastline, which caused the channel to form in the end. It was almost like these cascading water that was trapped in the North Sea wanted to flow through the channel and created some quite waterfalls as well under the sea. So, yeah, really fascinating dive into the history of that area and some great examples of it. But once again, if we want to preserve the history while modernizing and utilizing scarce resources, including land that is barely under the water, and we want to know about our past, then we should consider it in the same way as we do, as you said.
Yeah,
and it, the land shouldn't be any different to, under the murky waters of the North Sea.
Yeah, and as always, it's these challenges that provide probably the most interesting opportunities for new technology, not only in obviously production of energy, but in terms of the archaeological side of things. You can't just go out there and, you know, with a brush and a shovel and dig things up. You've got to use things like, I guess, LIDAR and sonar and all of these various satellite mapping techniques and things like that, that are, yeah, quite incredible. So you're doing Indiana Jones stuff from a distance of thousands of miles.
Absolutely. So obviously not an area we're familiar with, but it really does touch on many of the humanities, I guess, and science. When we look into first Britain specifically to dramatically increase its use of offshore power.
Absolutely.
There's good reasons for that.
Yes. In terms of the archaeological stuff, we'll pop a couple of links into the description and also, a link to the actual wind farm itself, because that's, even on its own is quite impressive, the sort of, the wind turbines on the size I've never seen before. I think there was one statistic I read that a single rotation of the blade is enough to power a house for 2 days. So these are big things. They're quite incredible on their own. But yeah, we'll pop links to everything in the description.
Yeah, just to touch on that, because we didn't talk on the technology side, but the phase of installation will get to a capacity of 3.6 gigawatts of energy. Enough to power 6 million homes. So that's the size of scale we're talking about, the project involved in creating that wind farm.
Yes, yeah. So very impressive on one side, but yeah, it's finding that balance between preserving of history and helping us preserve the future as well, I guess.
Excellent.
For sure. All righty. So our tech spot for this week, as we mentioned at the beginning, is anarchic manufacturing. As perhaps the industry expert in this situation, you may well have to pick up the reins here, but I hope, you'll be able to teach me a little bit something about what anarchic manufacturing is, and hopefully the listeners as well. And again, we'll put links to everything. There's a couple of papers by our previous podcast guest, Aidan Nasahi, who's really the expert on it, that goes into it. But yeah, it's such an interesting idea that we wanted to bring it back in and perhaps do a bit more of a deep dive on it as well.
And we've talked in the past in series one of the podcast around planning and scheduling systems. We talked to a few people about planning and scheduling systems. So What interested me when we brought up this terminology was, can you produce a system of being able to plan when things need to happen within a manufacturing facility that's different from the traditional, if you like, planning and scheduling systems that are available to us today. So before we dive into what anarchic manufacturing is, we'll touch on just a little bit of a reminder about what planning and scheduling systems are. So predominantly what the planning systems are is all about driving the supply chain to plan out those activities to make sure that you've got enough materials, whether raw materials or semi-finished materials, products, to be able to carry out either just-in-time manufacturing or be able to create warehousing so you can store that materials. So when you want to be able to carry out that manufacturing, you've got the materials available to you. Mm-hmm. And materials tend to fall into different types. So whether they're short lead items or long lead items, you've got to plan that activity to make your supply chain operate to bring everything together to be able to carry out what you need to manufacture. And businesses spend a lot of time looking at that whole supply chain. And it's, once again, another big news item when supply chains don't function properly or the raw materials aren't available and the security of those more raw materials aren't available, then that can have a big knock-on effect on the supply chain, and we've seen that with chips recently.
Exactly. Yes, yeah, last few years.
So planning is very much, in my mind, is about being able to look and forecast quite far into the future and try and making sure that you can bring those material to a point where you can manufacture them to be able to produce some level of product. The scheduling side can be fall into two ways. You can do scheduling that is, assumes infinite resources. So scheduling is now looking at a smaller time frame when you're trying to actually produce things. So you might be thinking not just of materials when you talk about scheduling, you're talking about people or equipment and how those three things with the materials coincide to be able to produce your product. So you can have scheduling that is assumes an infinite set of resources, or you can have a resource constrained schedule.
As in, we have access to X amount of this that will produce Y amount of product.
Yeah, and also you're looking for things that are in work in progress or in transit, because depending on your warehouse size, you might have 3 weeks worth of warehouse stock, or you might have 3 days. And that's that difference between just-in-time manufacturing. If you're doing just-in-time manufacturing, you're very much thinking of a lorry as a part of your warehouse system, and how long does it take for the lorry to get into your warehouse? So do you unload it and just have your stock available at line side, or do you have to have some staging warehouses? And that's all about de-risking your supply chain. But the problem with de-risking your supply chain is then you have to build a warehouse, and that warehouse costs money. So all of these are decisions that businesses take based on the risk of their, or the certainty they have in their supply chains and the risks they're taking in this way to mitigate the risk within their supply chain. And it's all about producing the right quality, being able to deliver the right quality at the right time to produce what you need to be able to do. So that's your kind of planning and scheduling dimension. And there are systems out there that allow you to do some real finite planning, given the fact of everything that we've talked about. How much warehouse space do you have? It looks at your delivery orders to work out what's being ordered and when those deliveries are expecting. And then it's looking at how much people you have, how much equipment you have. And those systems are your advanced planning and scheduling systems that are probably the standard way that most businesses operate today. And then anarchic is a slightly different, well, it's a very different approach.
You would hope so, when it was, given the title, yeah. You want to inject a bit of anarchy.
Yeah, and in this case, it's very much about the structures. So even though the, you know, the phrase anarchic has different connotations to people, what it actually really means is a level of devolution, if you like. It's allowing almost like free market principles to apply to a system, which is all to do with, is it available? Can I negotiate if I'm going to do something? And there's a level of negotiation that goes on but behind all of these actors within the system. So once again, we talk about the existing model, which is very much a hierarchical model. A hierarchical model means that we have this product we want to make, and then we break down all of that into its smallest parts, which humans are very good at. You know, problem solving is traditionally breaking down everything into its smallest parts to try and rationalize the problem and then roll it all back up again. It's not necessarily a great system thinking approach, but that's how we tend to solve problems. An anarchic approach, like in the free market principle, is where you allow all the actors to decide within the system. So there's a level of autonomy at individual level to decide. So what this means is the individual machine decides whether it's available to make that thing. The individual products decide where they are. And it's about us trying to get to this cyber physical systems, which were is a very popular term, cyber physical systems, when Industry 4 was talked about. but it's all about an autonomy within the system, and the system negotiates its own result to create a flexible, reconfigurable system that comes up with the best answer for itself. And there is no central actor who's trying to organize everything.
I was going to ask that, because a lot of what we talked about last time with Aidan was how smart is smart manufacturing? And this is, I guess, the other side of it. So when you're talking about actors and the decisions made, a lot of it is automated decisions, basically, smart equipment and smart systems that understand the ingredients that go into creating a product and then make a decision themselves. I think that's what Aidan was getting at with the difference between, or the definition of automation is when it's not a human deciding it, but the system itself that's going, well, now we can produce X amount of Y. That's what we're looking at here, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's all about agency, and the terminology agency is means that, you know, with the system we have today, there's a central agency, there's a single planner generally who's working with the system to generate these plans. You know, there may be some organizations have two or three planners, but ultimately the decision is with one human that's looking at the system and putting that in. With these type of systems, the agency lives within the system itself, and the system negotiates based on a set of rules, negotiates with other actors within the system what they should be doing next, when and how. And that's basic. So a completely different approach. And some of this, like I said, taps into the concept of cyber physical systems. It taps into that kind of ideology around Industry 4. And the fact that you can have a chip embedded in everything and everything can talk to each other as long as it can have the same language. So this study that they put together was challenging, can a cyber physical system or an anarchic system perform as well as the paradigm we have today? And it used a lot of computer modeling to understand if those intelligent decision-making agents can perform in the same way as a normal system. And it uses lots of different scenarios. So mix of products, how many steps in an operation can you utilize, how many changes, you know, if a machine breaks down, what kind of impact that has. And what he said within the interview that interested me very much was actually an anarchic system performed just as well under certain scenarios as a hierarchical system. There are some additional complexities to that you've got to the system itself. You've got to have a system where you have a level of intelligence built within it, and you've got to have all of the protocols and the communication for that system to be able to talk to each other. So you do have to have an agent-based system set up. So, you know, there are some pros and cons around that, because if you don't have one of those today, then obviously there's a level of capital investment around those types of anarchic systems. But to build a model within a computer to prove out the concept of it, is really where they were at, really, through the system. So pretty much under most conditions, it performed just as well as the hierarchical model, which, like I said, I found quite fascinating. The other point through the discussions I had with him was, under all of those scenarios, there's some scenarios that performed better, where there was disruption in the system and you wanted to reconfigure the system, it performed better. But if you were having a very steady state scenario, the other one performed, the hierarchical model performed better. But you do need to be able to have everything talking to each other in this machine agent based approach. That's the crux of it, really.
And I presume this is one of those areas of technology that would, if put into practice, really benefit from things like machine learning, improving the AI systems that are in there. So it might like you say, at the moment in a test phase, operate better in some circumstances as well in others, and slightly worse in others. But it's the more it runs, the better it gets, basically.
Well, that would be the principle of it, but there's only a finite improvement in that space, you know. So that's the trouble with some of these. You're trying to squeeze more and more efficiency out of a system that's already efficient. Or there's some natural disturbance in the system, and that chaos, if you like, in the system can't be modeled within a system. And therefore, actually, the human brain, you know, we talked about planners and planners planning the schedule, but you have lots of people within a facility who are reacting in real time to real time scenarios. And how do you model that? How do you capture what humans are thinking on the shop floor and what decisions they're making? We're already optimizing it based on the fact that we have a system, and that system just happens to be a human system in place. And so, you know, you're trying to squeeze probably not a lot out of the spare capacity anyway. So what he actually said when I was discussing it the other day is that actually there's probably some simpler frameworks in place, and we'll touch on them another day. But that's what I find fascinating. You go through the study, you prove out you can have an equivalent using a non-market-based approach to what we have today, but actually maybe simplification of the system is better, and not driving down a more complicated scenario. Because if you can achieve the same results with a simple system, then that is even better.
That's going to be more robust.
Yeah, so he did point me at some of the latest studies they've done, which we're not going to cover today, but we will in another one. About, it's called Graduation Intelligence Manufacturing System, an Industry 4 paradigm for production operations management. There you go, there's the title. And it looked at the scenarios between how graduation, as in, you know, people graduating from universities, how different countries approach the challenge of organizing graduations. And can you apply those paradigms to a manufacturing environment? And in his words, that's a simpler way of solving the same problem, but using a completely different approach. And so, yeah, interesting to see if we can get to a perfect point where we have a simple system that performs just as well for the planning, or at least the scheduling of work, that doesn't require this autonomy approach or an anarchic approach. Maybe there's just a lovely middle ground here that has a far simpler solution to this problem. But we'll touch on that another time.
I was going to say, yeah, it's a good teaser for a future episode. We will certainly come back and discuss that next time. Not next time, but in the future.
Excellent.
Alrighty, let's jump into our interview with Mark Leitchens. Without further ado. And so, joining us for this interview portion of the Atlas podcast is Mark Leitchens. Long and varied career, but for the last almost 10 years has been the founder, entrepreneur, and business development specialist of Mark Global. Welcome to the podcast. So if you'd like to give us a bit of a potted history, how you got to where you are today, that'd be great.
Hi guys. I'm Mark Leitchens. Where should I start? It was quite a long journey. I started at school. Yeah. So, my background is really in entrepreneurship and business administration. So that's my educational background. And, I rolled into, the technology field, just after my studies. And I've been in there for quite a long time, or ever since.
So what was the thing that brought you into that kind of business studies side of life?
Actually, just by for my business, for my study, you mean?
It's, yeah. What made you interested in it? Did you just fall into it? But you know, business studies.
No, I think it's really the entrepreneurial side of things which really caught my interest. I think that's really in my character. Yeah, so I'm really an explorer. Love to try out new things, and if I can combine that with doing business, that's great. So that's basically what drove me into the business side of things. Yeah. So.
Were there any people that you looked up to that drove you in that direction? Was there any, you know, business people that you admired and wanted to follow in that footsteps, or was it just something you were interested in?
No, I think it's I wanted to be an accountant, and I never understood why that was in my mind for such a long time. So I was very happy that I went a different path. but I didn't necessarily have somebody where I, you know, which inspired me or something. I think I just followed my heart. Yes.
Excellent. So there was an inbuilt motivation from day one to explore through curiosity, maybe, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. So the good thing is I during my study I lived with my uncle and my auntie for 5 years. So and they really inspired me to explore the world, basically. And I'm very grateful for that. So that's what brought me to the next level and into eventually the technology field and starting up businesses all over the globe. Yeah.
Excellent. And what about, so we've looked at the business side, but what was it about technology? Was that once again a fortuitous step, or did you have a passion about or did you see technology helping solve problems, maybe?
I think I just rolled into it, so by accident. I think I needed to when I was in the last year of my study, we needed to do an internship abroad. And we phoned up a couple of companies at that time, and one happened to be ATS, where I worked for quite a long time. But that's where my technology eyed open. Yeah, so that's where it all started. And I was not technology savvy at all. So, you know, I was just really fresh in the field and learned quite a lot. I love to see what you can do with it, but I'm not a really deep technician, if I might say. Yeah.
And was there one particular thing there, one particular use of technology that made you see the value in the technology from a business point of view that kind of merged those two things?
Yeah, I think what caught my interest was that I walked into a factory for the first time. I had never seen a factory where they make stuff. And for some reason, I was just perplexed by what technology can do. Yeah, so it's not only on the mechanical side, but also on the electrical side of things. And I think that inspired me from that day on, and see what technology can bring to the globe or to the world, to help people to do their jobs better or make interesting products.
We have this program in the UK called Inside the Factory, and it feels like a bit of a busman's holiday to me, as in I don't really want to watch it, because I'm sure it'd be one of those frustrating things where you look at the factory and go, no, that's not how it happens. But you're also very aware that not many people get to see inside a factory, or not many people get to see inside multiple factories and how they operate. So it is a bit of an alien world to most people, and landing inside something and trying to make sense of what's going on and what his purpose is to society is quite is quite perplexing, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely is.
So the scale, I think some people, or we maybe as humans struggle a little bit with this concept of scale, because we kind of think, oh yeah, you'd be able to do that. Oh, I could do that on my own without this type of thing. And then you say, well, you've got to produce 100,000 of them identically, whatever thing you're making has got to be more millions of them identically with very, very few defects. Then you kind of go, yeah, you couldn't do that. So going from that artisan or craft-based world to the world of a fully automated factory, they are miles apart in a way, aren't they?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so it's, but I think, that's the great thing. Yes, I think there's a lot of variety going on there, and I'm happy to see that it's evolving as well. Yeah, so you see, it's getting better and better and better. Not only that things are made better, but also the people working in these environments, for example, they can do their job better, more healthier, etc., etc. So that's a big change.
Yeah. So you end up setting up your own business, going out on your own. What was that like for you, setting up the probably where you wanted to be ultimately, by the sounds of it, from your business school days? But
yeah, absolutely. I think it felt like a dream. Yeah. So I thought, well, finally I'm on my own. And I signed the paper at the Chamber of Commerce. I can remember that day, as it was today. And you feel free. You can explore, and you need to do your own thing. But at the end of the day, you need to do all by yourself. As from that time, there's little help. And then that's great. So you go back to the basics. And start building up gradually a company that that eventually is profitable. But it has been a long route, so I think it's not something that that we did over time. Over time we needed that that effort and that commitment to really make it work. And what I always find is you can keep on exploring new things, and that's what makes it really interesting. And seek the boundaries of what people what makes them tick. What really inspires them, where you can help them in a very unique way. And I think, and that uniqueness, I think that's the most crucial thing which I'm looking for in the business. To help other businesses as well. So I always keep that in the back of my mind. Maybe to give you a little bit of background what we did. Mark Global is really a business development company. So we help businesses in seeking the differentiating abilities and capabilities and develop them for them so that they can thrive. And that varies from HR things to strategy development to really improve factory floors, and help them in certain very difficult topics. And what I liked about it, is that you're using new technology as the enabler to really make it happen and assist them in the correct way. And that has been very, very challenging. So what we do, or what we've done, we work mostly for technology-based companies. In the first few years, I developed a specific commercial approach where they could benefit from. Yeah, so it's a go-to-market strategy approach, and we developed that methodology here in the company. And we mostly work for robotic companies, for big data companies, for companies that were trying to build products around artificial intelligence, for example. We work for information security companies and engineering firms. And that's actually was so exciting because we got to learn what that technology specifically could do. Yeah, so they were really exploring in those fields, and we needed to help them, yeah, to get it to the market. Yeah, and obviously these kind of topics or technologies, they were, yeah, in a very early stage. So yeah, you're looking for a particular group of companies or customers where they can sell it to. Yeah, so they need to do the propositions, etc., etc. And that was really exciting. So I got to learn a lot about these type of technologies and how these companies work, but also what could it bring to their customers. And I think, I'm very, very grateful for that. For some reason, it really helps me to build more insights, but also, think a lot more out of the box. Yeah, when you're talking to CEOs or whatever, or entrepreneurs, which are looking for to really build their company.
Yeah, and that's an important thing, isn't it? Because there are multiple ways to solve the same problem, and with new technologies, there's even more ways to solve the same problem.
Absolutely,
but yeah. There are different levels of maturity, and this whole adoption curve, if you like, is people. There may be early adopters, but those early adopters can really benefit if they take a strong approach. Yeah. And some businesses, that's easier to do with others, I guess, than with others. When you set up your business, what were the things that if you could tell yourself, if you could look back on it, what were the things you learned or the mistakes you made that you learned from when setting up your own business? Can you think of any particular circumstances?
Oh, absolutely. I made tons of mistakes. that's the great thing, I think. Otherwise, you stop learning. And I think that's really valuable. Yeah. I think one of the most interesting things was when I hired my first employees. And after a few years, I understood that I didn't want to have any employees anymore. And I think that was a crucial thing which changed my way of doing business, and how I believe modern organizations can thrive. And one of the lessons, or one of the things which came out of that, actually, was that I built Mark Global as a network organization. And that was a lot of effort to get the right people with the right skill sets, with the right mindsets all together, and build a team around that with different capabilities and abilities from people, which is great.
So it's more like a collaboration, is it? A collaboration?
Yes, it's really network. A collaboration. Yeah. And we all develop the company. Yeah, so that's the great thing. And they do very interesting projects and very quickly. Yeah, so that's the main differentiator which we have at the moment at Mark Global, for example. So that's one of the things which I learned when being an entrepreneur and having some lessons learned. I think another lesson learned for me would be that I'm sometimes very far ahead in my thinking. And that is sometimes an advantage, but in most cases, it's really a challenge. So I can see the end picture, But I need to learn to take a few steps back and to be able to communicate that to, for example, teams at our customers or even in my own team. Yeah, to see can you really follow? Yeah, And that's I think that's one of the main lessons I've learned in the past few years. Yeah, absolutely.
And that's
still one of my challenges.
Good. And in the sort of almost 10 years that you've been running Mark Global, what area of technology have you seen develop or change that has helped most from your side? Because obviously you've helped clients and businesses who are developing their own technology, but is there any technology that you use or that you have adopted that you've noticed in the time Mark Global has been running has made a big difference?
Yeah, if I just look at on what we've tried internally here within the organization, we have experimented with artificial intelligence, mostly on the sales side and also on the HR side. So what my thought process was behind that was that I wanted to test markets automatically for our customers, but I needed to understand that very well how that needed to be done. So we experimented with that kind of tooling. I think for about 3 years now. And we are still not, we did not master it yet. So we are still in that learning curve and also how it actually can help our customers really. And I see that there's, it's not fully developed yet. So it's really still under development. And then that's what I see. There's great stuff out there, but there's still a lot of stuff to find out. And I think that's one of the learnings which I've got from using a particular technology, for example, in our own organization, but also helping customers with that.
Yeah, and also it's understanding the data or the data stewardship of it, isn't it? Making sure it's aligned with what you expect it to mean. And it does take a bit of cleansing and sorting out sometimes. It depends how new that system is or whatever it is. But there is a level of dedication required or understanding from the human point of view whether the data that you're making assumptions based on are of the right the right quality or
so. Yeah, absolutely. For example, such tooling which we are using or experimenting with to test markets for our customers. It's also scraping the internet. Yeah. Mm. And sometimes there's just not sufficient information available because potential customers from our customers, they need to leave a digital trail as well. And sometimes it's not really there. Yeah. So, and that's one of the learnings which we had in this kind of experimental phases, which sometimes you don't think about, but once you experience that, it comes as a surprise.
We've touched on it before about talking about open, shared, and closed data, and I think if businesses think in those kind of ways, then there is a certain amount that you want to put out into the public domain to make yourself visible. But you have to obviously do it in the right format or whatever it is. But a lot of people still think a website is their digital footprint on the world. But there's lots of other ways of getting that open data available for people to find you. And some of that is not just through your social media sites as well. And a lot of work still needs to be done, I think, in that open understanding the power and benefit of open data and the power of those kind of connections that open data can make. Businesses are still a little bit shy from sharing and controlling what they share. But we'll see how that develops in the future, I think, as more supply chains and collaborations evolve. But it sounds like from a human-to-human point of view, you've definitely looked at your business as a collaboration entity, a way of scaling globally without necessarily having to scale inwardly, if you like. Was that standard? So what's the future hold for you and your business, Emma?
I think we are currently working on developing our business model. So, and what we are particularly looking at is looking at different approaches in how economics work and how businesses work. And it's really in the exploration phase at the moment. But I think I want to develop a new sort of organization, which is an example to, or can be an example to many, on how I believe new organizations or existing organizations should be run. And then I'm looking at more in the perspectives of sustainability. Yeah. So it's not about money and shareholders' value, but it's much more moving towards on how we interact with nature. Yeah, and make sure that business is good for the planet. Yeah. So to make it very futuristic, yeah, but these kind of business models we are currently exploring. So it's not about making more money, but the money we make, the profits we make, we actually feed them back into the community, yeah, to accelerate the way of our customers do business. Yeah.
And have you seen some good examples of that? I mean, there are some things trying to do that, like with B Corp and things like this, and very social enterprises and things.
Yes.
What examples can you give?
We are talking to various companies right now to learn from them and basically what their experiences are. And I think a really nice example of that is an example from Melanie Rebeck. She runs an information security company or cybersecurity company. And she arranges a business model based on post-growth, as they call it. So looking beyond growth, but really feed that back into NGOs and that sort of thing. So she's not focusing on shareholders' value, but really giving the money back into the community again. And she's a really good example on a successful way of doing that to me. Okay. Yeah. So
very exciting. I think we'll probably have to find some links and put that in the episode description so people can do some investigation themselves as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So I definitely would encourage that to look at it. I think that's really the path which we are working towards too. And we're not there yet. I think it takes a couple of years to really embed that and really get it out there, but I think it's crucial for the next few years because we really need to change. It's exciting to me. I think if it can bring something back to the planet, that would be great. And if technology can help with that, that's terrific. And other ideas and inspirations, if they can help, that's really good as well. So.
Yeah, it's one of those great pairings of it's a challenge that brings a lot of opportunity as well.
Absolutely, yeah.
All righty. I'm looking at the time. I think we're rubbing up towards the end of our interview here. If there's anything else you wanted to put across, Martin, any questions or anything else you wanted us to have a look at, Mark?
No, I can't come up so quickly with anything, but I think if you... read some books on existential economy and degrowth and post-growth. I think if you look into that area a little bit, I hope you get inspired a little bit.
Yeah, for sure.
Absolutely. And think what changes are possible and how we could move forward.
Yeah, and we'll have to have you back on soon to maybe deep dive into those topics too.
Great.
Once
I would love to.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much, Mark. That was very informative, and I think there's some diamonds there at the end that we need to uncover a bit more information about. So thank you for that.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you.
Alrighty. So that's it for another episode of the Atlas Podcast. Thank you so much for joining me, Martin.
As always, Alex, it was a pleasure, and it's great to hear from Mark about his interesting views on his approaches to consultancy and the like. Great to hear from him.
Absolutely. We are joined next time by Ella Podmore, who's going to be talking to us about materials engineering and her work with McLaren and all sorts of fascinating things. And going to be a good time.
We tried to get some secrets out of it, but I don't know if we succeeded there.
Turns out McLaren have very tight NDAs. Who would have thought?
It's no harm in asking, is there?
Yeah, of course. You got to push the boundaries somehow. Anyway, I will see you then.
All right. Look forward to it.
For more information on Atlas and the projects we're involved in, head over to weareatlas.com. And to keep up to date with us, follow us on Twitter and Instagram at ats_Atlas and on LinkedIn at ats-Atlas.